Our first case, the attorneys are in Las Vegas, so I'm going to actually turn it over to Justice Pickering to run it since the attorneys are in front of her, and she can announce the appearances and all for the various parties, and then we'll run the clocks both here in Carson City and in Las Vegas, so they'll be close, but they may not be identical on doing that. So Justice Pickering, let me turn it over to you now, if you could call the case and announce the attorneys, and we'll go ahead and proceed.
Thank you very much, Chief Justice Gibbons. This is the time and place set for oral argument in Rigetti v. State, case number 73015. Both counsel are here in Las Vegas. Each side has 30 minutes today, and I would ask counsel for the appellant to state when he begins how much time he wants to reserve for rebuttal. The light will be run from down here on the podium, so that's the controlling light on the time warnings that you get, but they're also running it in Carson City. There will be some delay. I've done one oral argument video like this before, and when one of the justices speaks from Carson City, you need to pause and let them finish because the sound will bounce otherwise, and I know neither of these lawyers interrupts justices, but it's an extra pause. Just pause an extra beat, and we'll try to extend the same courtesy to all of you. So, counsel for the appellant, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, thank you.
Please do. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Ryan Vasher, one of the two trial attorneys for the appellant, Javier Rigetti, in this matter. I'd like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Very well.
I also want to thank your staff and the court for this accommodation, as it was a little gnarly up there from what I could see, so thank you. In this case, the district court set aside the felony murder plea but never considered the intertwined nature of the other felony guilty pleas, thereby violating the appellant's due process rights and fair trial guarantees. The district court erred in setting aside the plea to count 10 as it was accepted knowingly and voluntarily, and the consequences left us in an untenable situation where we had pleas entered to guilt, counts 1 through 9, 4 of which include felony murder theories that would be attached to the murder count. And finally, I would submit that the torture aggravator should have been stricken. Going into the rejection of the plea to count 10, as this court's aware, the state in this case pled three separate and distinct theories, which would substantiate a conviction for first-degree murder, premeditation and deliberation, felony murder theories under kidnapping, sexual assault, robbery, and finally by means of torture. What is interesting and unique is that what the court has required in this particular case is that Mr. Rigetti would have to enter pleas of guilty to all three theories. Yet a jury wouldn't have to do the same thing. A jury could convict Mr. Rigetti on one theory or on a combination of theories. Four could have said felony murder, four could have said premeditation, deliberation, four could have said torture, and that's enough. And that is a guilty finding as to first degree murder, subjecting Javier potentially to the death penalty and qualifying him for such as long as an aggravator was proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and that aggravator outweighed any mitigating circumstances. I submit that having a different standard between what a jury would have to do and what the defendant would have to do is a violation of due process, and it is simply, and as simply put, just not fair.
What authority do you have specifically for the due process point?
Specific authority, none. But in the fundamental fairness of the, you know, our constitutional protections, that's where I would submit it. It goes beyond a specific statute or say a specific precedent to the point where it's directly constitutional.
And did you make that argument in your writ petition?
In the original writ petition?
Sir.
Yes, we did. We did submit that it was a violation.
Of due process as well as double jeopardy, or was that premise?
Just a due process, if I recall correctly.
Well, no, the premise, the large premise for the writ was due double jeopardy.
Correct, but in reviewing the record in this particular case, I recall a fundamental fairness situation, due process situation.
So your position is that you urged both due process and double jeopardy in the writ proceeding before this court?
Correct.
Before. And I'll let you go with your argument in just a moment, but I want to confirm that at no time did you move to set aside the plea as to counts 1 through 9.
No, no one did.
Thank you.
What we do know about Javier's plea that day was that he could enter it without negotiations, that he understood the consequences of the plea and the nature of the offenses charged.
I'm going to interrupt now. Okay. You say he entered it without negotiations, but effectively, how do you distinguish this from Sandy when you walk in and you claim it's a straight-up plea, but by your plea and by him not admitting to premeditation, deliberation, you effectively get him out of the death penalty. Effectively, from that plea, even though it's not to a lesser charge, like an involuntary, you effectively, by your plea, that's not a straight-up plea because you changed the penalty by the plea. So isn't this more like Sandy?
I would submit no. And let's say the court agreed with us. And because of the nature of the plea, because it was entered, and because Javier was adjudicated, it couldn't be undone. Well, now we've gone from 14 aggravating circumstances to 8. He's still subject to the exact same punishment. He's still in jeopardy of defacing the death penalty. He's still qualified for the death penalty.
It's my understanding, though, you made sure through that plea that death would be off the table. That's why it was undone.
No, absolutely not, Your Honor. Like I said, if we had a grand success there, we would have gone from 14 to 8. There were aggravators not correlated with the felony murder theory. So, for instance, there was an entire other victim, and an entire other victim had 5 counts, and those 5 counts still were considered violent felonies, therefore qualifying under as an aggravator. There was a torture aggravator. There was, I'm just thinking, there's something off the top of my head. Certainly he was in extreme jeopardy, even if we were successful.
So you're saying that even through your plea, that he was still subject to the death penalty, even before the judge unwound the plea?
100%. We knew we were going to penalty, and we knew we were going to penalty where he faced the death penalty.
Mr. Masher, it would have significantly reduced the number of aggravators, though, correct?
In number, certainly, I would not necessarily agree when it comes to the quality of the aggravators themselves, in the sense that it is that double counting that we worry about in McConnell. There were, you know, certainly some strong aggravators out there that we would and did have to face.
But what I'm saying is, I guess, is it's up to the, isn't it up to the state? The state files the notice of death. The state files the aggravator. It's up to the state on the charges and the penalty. And by your plea, you took that power away from the state just by that plea. It's not a straight-up plea.
I understand, of course, Your Honor's point, but when we did so where the court accepted the plea, asked the state if they were satisfied with the plea twice. They indicated that they were. And then, after the plea was accepted, he was adjudicated then and there. And so this isn't a situation where Ms. Craig was prepared to have the argument you're bringing up right now in court had an objection been made. But with the record as it was, an objection wasn't made. The plea was accepted. It was our position that it should not have been undone, as there was no legal basis to do so. I mean, obviously, we respect Your Honor's rulings in the writ of mandamus. However, I would submit that this is this particular issue before this court now is slightly different, because we're not just talking about count 10 anymore. We're talking about the consequences of not letting count 10 stand and letting counts 1 through 9 remain.
Yeah, but you never asked to vacate the plea as to counts 1 through 9.
Correct. We didn't. Our object in entering the plea to counts 1 through 9 was to strike aggravators.
Sure.
Mr. Basher.
Were there any... Justice Hardesty, please.
Mr. Basher, could you clarify something for me? I guess I'm a little bit of a loss as to what the object was here. At volume 4 on record on appeal 896, Craig admitted that she had intentionally interrupted the court to obtain a benefit from Rigetti. but she argued it was good lawyering, not trickery. Are you in a position to explain to me what the good lawyering objective was from this plea process that you all were involved in?
Yes, Your Honor. First of all, and maybe this is an allegiance to a friend and a colleague, I do think it was very good lawyering. I also submit, Your Honor, that this happens all the time in every circumstance, be it anywhere from a deposition to a trial to when there's a failure to object, the record is made.
I don't want to compare other cases. I'm trying to understand, in this case, your colleague said this was good lawyering. And I'm trying to understand what was the objective of the good lawyering. Were you trying to eliminate aggravators? Were you trying to create a double jeopardy situation, as was discussed in the opinion in the writ? What were you trying to do here? It's just not clear to me why this was something other than something that I might not have seen every day. Maybe you do.
Your Honor, it's correct. I don't see it every day. To answer your question directly, yes, we were trying to strike aggravators. We were trying to save Javier's life. And we figured that the lesser aggravators meant a lesser likelihood of the death penalty being imposed. As Your Honors wrote in the writ of mandamus ruling, this is a very unique set of circumstances. That's a quote from this court. We don't see this every day. I'll be absolutely frank with that. But when we read Wilson and McConnell together, we saw an opportunity aware that if he did not plead to premeditation and deliberation, we potentially could have gotten 6 of the 14 aggravators, lessening his jeopardy to face death.
Okay, why can't the district court use the same standard, manifest injustice or what's fair and just under Stevenson, to withdraw that plea?
Yes, and that's what we were...
To withdraw the plea, though, for the state. Why can't that be used?
It can be used, and our argument should have been used by the district court in this particular case. This is a manifest injustice. We're now going to trial where we can't say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, he's presumed innocent, except he's not because he pled the 4 underlying felonies for the felony murder theory. Or the state doesn't have the burden of proof any longer, because they don't. There's a plea to the 4 counts. The state's solution was, we'll prove those up independently.
No, I'm saying... You're saying the district court erred by withdrawing the plea to begin with.
Correct.
And so I'm saying to you, why can't we use the same standard that we use for all withdrawals of plea, which is what's fair and just under Stevenson and manifest injustice? Why can't we apply those same standards to what happened here, where what appears that good lawyering occurred?
Fair enough.
To the detriment of the state.
And excuse me for interrupting there.
Go ahead.
It's an all or nothing then. I would submit you're absolutely right. It's a manifest injustice that, call it good lawyering or what happened, that certainly the district court may have been correct in rejecting the plea to count 10. Well, there's just as much manifest injustice and prejudice to letting counts 1 through 9 stand.
Well, why didn't you ask for a withdrawal plea? Why didn't she ask for that withdrawal plea, and then you'd start exactly at square one for both of you?
And I knew this question was going to come, of course, because it's an important one.
It's a strategy, is it not? Isn't that a strategy determination, just like she strategized on the plea?
No, it's not a strategy situation for a few reasons. We entered those pleas in an attempt to strike aggravators. That was the strategy. We lived the belief that, first of all, the answer to your question is not in the record below. Maybe it will be one day.
As a feeling.
Right. Second, the fact that Your Honor is asking that question, I would argue exactly exemplifies and shows why there's a problem here. That there's an uncomfortableness that this trial went forward with pleas to 1 through 9 and not count 10. But the strategy there was not so that we could one day be in this position and answering that question. We entered those pleas with that understanding that we would be able to. And we twice brought it to the court's attention. We filed a motion in limine saying, what do we do now? And we filed an objection to what we called the trial phase process because we were stuck.
But your choice was you could have gone back to square one by moving to withdraw the plea, which you didn't do. And in your brief, you act as if the court refused to withdraw the plea. On page 20 of your opening brief on appeal, you say, by refusing to set aside all of Rigetti's guilty pleas, the district court denied Rigetti a fair trial. But the district court didn't refuse to set aside all of Rigetti's guilty pleas. It wasn't asked to set aside all of his pleas. I mean, and that's the fundamental premise I have. That's a fundamental problem I have with your argument. It's premised on the assumption that the district court refused to set aside the plea altogether, and it did not. It was not asked to.
And what is disconcerting is that we had no guarantee that, A, the court would do that. B, we believe
we didn't ask, so you don't know.
We didn't have a basis, in our opinions, to, and again, this is not in the record below, but
Probably shouldn't argue it.
Well, I mean, we can correct, in my opinion, the due process and fundamental fairness violation. Now we can wait 3 years on post-conviction relief where these questions are answered in the record below. I would submit that in these circumstances, the assumption that that she would set aside the plea when the state had presented its position that it could try the case without mentioning the prior pleas, found that acceptable. We twice asked the court, what are we doing?
Mr. Basher, could I interrupt what you're saying there, please? I'm trying to understand your argument on the court's error in not setting aside these pleas. Apparently, sua sponte is what you're contending. So, to be clear, the basis for your argument that the district court should have sua sponte set aside pleas to count 1 through 9 is a due process argument for which you offer no authority. Is that right?
Again, and I respectfully disagree with that.
Is that correct? Is that correct?
No, but my authority would be the Constitutions of the United States and the state of Nevada.
Okay.
And the Fifth Amendment.
Are any cases, anything besides a general reference to the United States and Nevada Constitution?
No, Your Honor, and I would submit that's because this is an extremely unique set of circumstances, as noted by this court in the ruling on the writ of mandamus.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Are you saying that it was a specific decision made not to seek to set aside the plea to the other 9 counts, as opposed to we just blew it?
That not being in the record below, and that me being second chair on the case, I don't know if I can confidently speak as to which of those alternatives it was, Your Honor.
Well, I guess we'll find out later. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. With your permission, with the 3 minutes and change I have, I'd like to discuss torture. We would submit and we filed a motion to strike the torture aggravator and torture theory, and that we submit the evidence didn't support torture as it is defined by Dominguez, in that it's designed to be pain beyond the killing itself. And that torture cannot be based on acts occurred after the victim has died.
I thought the jury was instructed on mutilation as opposed to torture, and that under Byford, posthumous mutilation will constitute an aggravator. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, you're absolutely correct, Your Honor. And I would submit this is the true irony in this case, is that the aggravator as defined is an or. It's torture or mutilation. In this context, we're going to use the definition of or as we all understand it. When we enter a plea to count 10, it's and or. And we...
Well, it was articulated and or in the charging document, too.
Correct. And meaning and or can stand. But you're absolutely right. We don't know whether the jury found that aggravator based on mutilation or torture. We know that the jury was instructed on mutilation at the penalty phase. They were told in the penalty phase instructions that don't forget your instructions from the guilt phase, which define torture.
Okay.
But we don't know, and from the record below, whether or not the jury found the mutilation for the purposes of that aggravator or found the torture itself. For those reasons, we sought to, by motion pre-trial, to have the torture aggravator stricken and were denied by the court below.
Mr. Basher?
Yes.
The torture theory was not on the special verdict form. Is that correct?
That's correct. Okay.
Is that a guilt phase or penalty phase that you're talking about?
That would be on the guilt phase. The special verdict form on the penalty phase articulated each and every surviving aggravator. There were originally 14 aggravators in the notice of intent to seek death. And maybe the state and I can both apologize that the record wasn't as clear below that while settling penalty instructions, the state struck two of the sexual assault aggravators and one of the torture aggravators. So only 11 ended up going to the jury. But I could see why the record below may not have been reflecting that as obvious as, you know, saying this is what we're doing. It just happened. With that, I'd like to reserve my remaining time.
Thank you. You have 10 minutes and 19 seconds by our count down here in Las Vegas. Mr. Pesci.
First off, Justices, from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for not having to fly yesterday. I'd like to start off with a question that all of you keep going to. And if I could, please indulge me, please.
Could you state your appearance, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. Giancarlo Pesci on behalf of the respondent.
Very well. Thank you.
So if we went to volumes 19 and volumes 20, if you could, please. Specific pin sites 4458 and 4459 in volume 20. So this is the argument in closing. Line 17. This is Ms. Craig. He pled guilty to counts 6 through 9 for the robbery, the sexual assault, and the kidnapping against Alyssa Otremba. He pled guilty to those a year ago. And you heard the state when they argued in the trial phase that felony murder is first-degree murder. And felony murder is any murder that occurs during the course of a robbery, a kidnapping, a sexual assault. He pled guilty. And you'll be able to see the document. It goes on to the next page, still in volume 20, page 4459. And the state does have a duty to prove the aggravators beyond a reasonable doubt. But because he pled guilty, they don't have to do that. Now, it's extremely important to put that argument in context with volume 19. So volume 19, specific sites 4273, Justices, this is the defendant's mitigation instruction. This is what the defense says is mitigation. And I would specifically direct your attentions to 4274, line 1. And it's listed as number 23. It says, 1 year ago, Javier pled guilty to counts 1 through 5 for the crimes against Michaela Kitchen. Now, for the benefit of the court, I'm sure you do know this, but I just want to go over it. Michaela Kitchen 1 through 5 is not the murder victim. She's a surviving victim. We can all understand the wise decision to have that be a plea so that the jury making the murder decision never hears about another young lady being raped in the same tunnel. So there's the reason. There's the answer to your question. But there's more. Still saying on volume 19, pin site 4274, line 22, specifically enumerated mitigator number 36. 1 year ago, Javier pled guilty to counts 6 through 9 for robbery, kidnapping, and sexual assault against Alyssa Trump. That's why, Justices, because they could stand in front of this jury and say it's a mitigator that he pled guilty. All of you have asked, why not seek to withdraw it? There's your answer. We don't have to wait 3 years. We don't have to wait for PCR. We know it because it's what they presented to this very jury. And Justice Hardesty, you asked the question I wanted to try to respond to. You specifically said, what was the objective of the lawyering? So, and I apologize, I don't have the volume, but I do have the pin site. So I would say, I would direct your attention to pin site 701, Justice Hardesty, which is the motion to strike aggravating circumstances and evidence in aggravation. 5 days after that plea, where there was the nonverbal communication, 5 days later, this is the answer. That's why they didn't. It's abundantly clear. Because in this motion, they sought to strike those aggravators. And Justice Silver, in response to your earlier question, in fact, he would still be facing the death penalty. However, they would have been able to strike at least three. So that's the reason why doing this lawyering, whatever way we want to characterize it, because 5 days later, they made their intent abundantly clear, which was to minimize the number of aggravators. Now, the fallback argument is, well, there are so many still left. Okay, that's true. But nonetheless, there would be at least three done away with right then and there, which is the reason why that lawyering was done the way it was. And as we pointed out, the reasons for not seeking to withdraw. And let's look specifically, Justice, if I could. It's volume 11. I'm not sure if it's 11A or 11, but the pin sites are specifically page 2303. So this is the interaction between the district court judge and defense counsel when talking about this concept of having these pleas and being stuck with these pleas. And the court, page 2303, volume 11, line 14, the court. I guess I'm wondering, what are you seeking from the court, Ms. Craig? Well, the court, if anything, Ms. Craig. Frankly, at this point, I don't really have a solution for the court. I mean, except for I think we're entitled to explain to the jury about the plea, we're entitled to have a, I would put up Ms. Loom to explain trial tactics and why the plea went down the way that it did, and why the Supreme Court ruled the way that it did, so that we have an opportunity to explain to the jury why we're not doing anything. So the question is, what's your remedy? Never did they avail themselves of the opportunity to seek to withdraw. Staying in that same volume, volume 11, just to show how this wasn't just a one-time thing, going to page 2306, the court, again. So I guess, what's your remedy? Don't go to trial because my client, I mean, I'm just trying to figure out what you're seeking. Ms. Craig, lines 15 through 23. I've never been in this position. This is the strangest position I've ever been in. The only remedy that I can think of is to explain to the jury the tactical decision and how we ended up in this very odd place of going to trial on first-degree murder, having completed a guilty plea on the underlying counts. See, the only reason that's stated there is because the intent is to utilize those pleas, as we pointed out, as mitigators. There was opportunity, it was not done, and there was a strategic reason for not doing it, because they got to do the very thing that the benefit of the plea was, which was to argue for it to be mitigation.
So what you're saying is, basically, they kept those pleas intact because you have a confession in this case. If they can just mitigate death, this is why this is done.
Anything to mitigate in a case like this, I think that we can all agree that the evidence was very strong in this case. And so anything to be able to mitigate would be something that the defense should do, and they did do. I mean, the plea for a short time was in place without the premeditation and deliberation. And 5 days later, the motion was filed to say, hey, strike those aggravators. So those are the reasons why. Kind of pivoting to the torture, and I'm grateful for the justices have pointed out, in the guilt phase, specifically, I think it was Justice Stiglitz, it's page 3453 and 3454. It's the verdict form for the guilt phase. And so because we had felony murder, we had to make sure we had a McConnell appropriate special verdict form. Your honors have told us to do this, and we take that to heart. So specifically, we have in the special verdict form for the finding of first degree murder that it was willful, deliberate, and premeditated. And this is page 3453. And then the unanimously find the murder was committed during the perpetration or attempted perpetration of robbery. Going to the next page, 3454, still the jury unanimously finds the murder was committed during the perpetration or attempted perpetration of kidnapping. And then finally, the jury unanimously find that the murder was committed during the perpetration or attempted perpetration of sexual assault. Torture wasn't put in front of them. And the rationale is because we're darned if we do, we're darned if we don't, right? If we do it there, then the argument can be we're double dipping.
But wait a minute. Page
4292
has special verdict says the murder involved torture or the mutilation of the victim. So you need to hedge that a bit. The special verdict on The aggravators lists that as the last.
So as Justice Kagan just pointed out, that's in the penalty phase. So the portion,
right.
The portion that I was reading originally, the guilt phase, we didn't put forth torture as a theory for them to determine guilt.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
I apologize if I misstated that. I'm very sorry. So in the penalty phase, it specifically was at play. And this court has already had cases where you talk about the or for torture or mutilation, that it's okay for that to be there. And, you know, in this particular case, the facts are egregious to qualify for both. In fact, I'm not going to do it. I've actually got the pictures, but I would ask you to look to respondent's appeal, because the state in its opposition, or I should say in its response, added some of the photos from the guilt phase. So response appeal pages 1 through 18 of them. It's the pictures from the crime scene and the autopsy of Alyssa Otremba. And there were over 80 stab wounds. The majority were anti-mortem. There was stabbing of this young woman that occurred before she was killed. They were very superficial stabs. But what's amazing in this case is you don't even have to guess as to why he did it. He specifically told the detective during his statement that he did it to feel, quote, gangster and thug, and he wanted to feel good. And then as far as mutilation, he admitted that he tried to carve the letters LV on her. Plus, I would really point you to, there's one particular photo that shows that her right leg, a good portion is just gone because of the burning that occurred, not just to her leg, her face, her chest, her vaginal area, but also to her leg. The mother, when she identified her, brought her own sock from her daughter's clothing to put on her daughter, to be able to at least touch her daughter. So mutilation and torture in this particular case was found, and you have specifically said in other cases that burning a body afterwards qualifies for that. I'm not sure if there are any other questions from the justices.
I'd like you to address whether and if so, to what extent the due process argument was litigated on the initial writ, and secondly, comment on your opposing colleague's argument that as a matter of fundamental fairness, due process was violated by him having to go to trial on the murder with the 9 counts pleaded guilty to already.
So I would start at the end if I could, Justice.
Yeah.
He had, the defendant that is, the appellant, I'm sorry, the opportunity to withdraw. He had that opportunity. So there's no due process, there's no fundamental fairness. He could have done it. He chose not to, and he had a strategic reason to do so. He could have asked to move to make the withdrawal. As Justice Silver said, we could do an analysis as to fundamental fairness and reasons why we could allow that to happen. He never availed himself of that. And I don't understand how, by so not availing, he's suffering from some sort of due process violation. So I apologize as far as...
So are you saying it's a waived argument? Or?
Yes, okay. 100%.
Or forfeited?
Yes. As far as... Justice Pickering, you offered, I believe, the decision in the February 16, 2017 denial of the writ. I have to be honest with you. I didn't reread it all thoroughly to understand if they did argue due process as a part of that or not. I would say even if they did, there's no violation of due process because it is the state's charging right.
But you're arguing, you're asking us to give preclusive effect to that prior determination. And the point of my question is, to the extent legal injury was allegedly inflicted after we refused to reinstate his plea as to count 10, is that precluded by that decision of ours, or should it be addressed on the merits or treated as waived? I'm trying to understand your analytics of this.
Okay, and I'm trying to understand the question. I apologize. So I think as far as res judicata and law of the case, this issue's already been resolved by this court pre-trial. So I think that binds the defendant, and he stuck with this decision. And the decision was sound, and there was nothing that violated fundamental fairness or due process. And so I don't see how we can bootstrap on a direct appeal, in essence, an appeal of a pretrial writ argument, and then couch it in the terms of the Constitution.
So yeah, he made purely a double jeopardy argument. I guess where I'm and I'm thinking out loud here, if he had made purely a double jeopardy argument on the first go-round, and certainly that was his focus.
Yes.
Would the determination that the ruling, the refusal to allow him to reinstate that plea, which is what he was asking us to do, that he didn't have a double jeopardy right to that, what does that leave open in terms of due process analytically when you go past that and he's proceeding to trial?
Okay.
I think he's trying to say he has a separate argument, but I don't read that in his brief either.
Assuming that it's not there, but it's being argued now, the due process violation, I don't think that there is any due process violation, because ask yourself, like, how was he deprived of due process? What is it that he didn't get to do that he could have done? He could have
moved
to withdraw. He chose not to. So that, I mean, that's my response.
And you're saying he had a strategic upside to that, which was it allowed him to have a mitigator that he took responsibility for what he had done.
Correct.
Yeah.
Justice Kadish, I think you were asking me something. I apologize.
She was, and I spoke over you, Justice Kadish. I'm sorry.
I was, but I think you just addressed it in your conversation, so thank you.
Thank you very much.
Are there any other questions from the North Country?
You're also saying, though, that upon remand from this court after the writ, that several times, and it was after the writ, that several times Judge Leavitt asked the defense, what's your remedy, what do you want me to do, almost inviting them to perhaps withdraw it, and because of the quandary, and still they didn't ask.
Correct, and it was, as you stated, factually after the ruling of this court and the writ. And then I would add to that, Justice, when the state of Nevada presented its case, we made a promise and we kept it. We never told this jury that the defendant had pled guilty. So we still have a verdict. We still have to convince a jury to avail ourselves of a felony murder theory that this, in fact, occurred during the course of those felonies. And if we fall down in the job, if we don't prove that beyond a reasonable doubt, notwithstanding the fact that he actually entered the pleas, the jury could come back without a verdict of first-degree murder under that theory, because we did not introduce it. We put him back at ground zero. It was his choice. He availed himself of that choice.
Thank you. Are there any other questions?
So just to be clear then, so, and I think you just said this, the guilty plea to counts 1 through 9 did not come up before the jury until the penalty phase.
Correct, Justice. Thank you very much.
Picking up where my colleague left off, Your Honors, we were nowhere near ground zero. We were stuck. We could not argue that he was innocent, that he was presumed innocent, that he had nothing to do with this, that it was somebody else.
Mr. Basher, if the pleas had been set aside, suddenly that quandary disappears. Could Ms. Craig then unhear the words that Righetti had admitted to rape and to murder, and then suddenly defend him differently than she had, could not do, strike that under count 10?
Absolutely, because if the pleas were then null and void, they didn't have any legal consequence or meaning.
But count 10 was null and void. Count 10 was a brand new charge at that point in time to be defended. Correct?
Except that that count included allegations that were intertwined in counts specifically 6 through 9, not so much 1 through 5. The basis of the felony murder theory, we could not get up there and say there was no sexual assault, there was no kidnapping, there was no robbery. A judge had accepted the pleas and adjudicated him guilty of those counts. We have a duty of candor.
And once they were set aside, a duty of candor is striking, considering where we are and how we got here. But once those are set aside, these pleas, you're in the same position that you argued before. So then you're going to tell the jury at that point he's presumed innocent?
Yes.
Okay, but for count 10, you can't, is what you're telling me. Okay.
Because they're intertwined.
So when you're going...
And as to the duty of candor, Your Honor, we entered a plea in open court. He was canvassed. The state was asked whether or not they were satisfied. The plea was accepted, and he was adjudicated. It happened in open court. There was no trickery. There was no lying. There was no cheating. A plea was accepted, and he was adjudicated. As for our strategy, Mr. Pesci is absolutely right. We knew that if no objection had occurred during the plea canvass and the plea was accepted and he was adjudicated, we were 100% going to file that motion to strike the aggravators. Since we're supplementing the record here, apparently, I can tell you that motion was written before we entered the plea, because that's exactly what we were going to do. We absolutely did this in an attempt to reduce the number of aggravators and thereby reduce his exposure to the death penalty. And again, I think there are two separate due process issues here. First, there's the due process issue of fundamental fairness, that why should a defendant have to plead to all three theories when a jury doesn't have to? That's due process issue number one. Due process issue number two, then, is what happens when we're in trial and can't refuse those
other... Let's talk about number one. Why should he have to plead to all three theories? He doesn't have to. He can plead not guilty and go to trial, correct? So he doesn't have to plead to all three theories. He doesn't have to plead to anything. Is that right?
Right.
Okay.
Well, and by pleading guilty to any theory of count 10, the state and the jury has done the exact same thing. They've gotten what they wanted, a conviction of first-degree murder. One theory in and of itself is enough. As I stated in my opening argument, they don't even have to agree on the theory. Again, I don't think the record below supports a discussion of what our strategy was. I understand Mr. Pesci has submitted his theory.
You were saying you had two due process theories.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. The second due process issue is our ability to defend in the trial. And I think we've gone over that.
So I still have a question about that. You're going to trial on the murder charge. The jury is not being told that he has pleaded guilty to all these other counts. State, as in every other case, has the burden of proving guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Why don't you argue all day, every day, that they haven't proven sexual assault beyond a reasonable doubt, they haven't proven robbery beyond a reasonable doubt, like any other case where someone pleaded guilty and then withdrew their plea? It's not, certainly not the first time, I'm sure even you've dealt with this issue.
Because I can't get up in penalty and say the opposite. And if we say they haven't proven sexual assault beyond a reasonable doubt, and I get up in penalty and say he pled guilty, or they find out at that point that he had pled guilty, I lied to the jury. And I'm sorry.
Okay.
And I'm not, respectfully, I'm not in the business of upsetting a bunch of jurors who are about to, you know, rule on my client's outcome.
I see. So it's because of losing credibility with the jury in the penalty phase.
Right, 100%.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate
it. But you guys stayed on the case,
Yes, but
in a lot of cases, obviously, somebody else comes in after a withdrawal plea, but you chose to stay on the case. Every other situation, where we have a withdrawal plea, somebody else comes in after the withdrawal plea, generally.
Mm-hmm.
A plea may be withdrawn, and that attorney picks up because of exactly what you're saying, but you didn't let go. You guys stayed on it. That was your choice, and I assume your client's choice that you stay on it.
And again, and I don't want to sound like a broken record, but these are great questions, but not questions that have answers in the record below. And this court has consistently resisted attempts by either side in any kind of litigation to supplement the record below.
It's almost like you're inviting error, though. You're asking over and over based on your own conduct. You're almost inviting it.
And again, maybe that will be borne out at some time down the road. I don't know.
Mr. Basher,
yes.
We're talking about due process, say those pleas had been set aside.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How are we in a different position right now? What is the theory under which he's acquitted of any of those nine charges that he pled guilty to, or the homicide?
And I get where you're going in the sense that it's harmless. It's kind of your analysis there. And I would submit that when you're talking about due process rights, and I don't mean to be to go on the side, and I will answer your question completely, Justice Stiglitz. But when Justice Pickering asked the respondent about whether or not the due process argument and the fundamental fairness arguments were waived, I don't think those can be waived. I think that because they're constitutional in nature, both state and federal, this aren't things that are suddenly waived because they weren't brought up. I believe a defendant has due process rights throughout the proceedings, all the way up through appeals and et cetera. But to answer your question, Justice Stiglitz, I guess I tie it back to the credibility issue with Justice Kadish, in the sense that we did this strategically to strike aggravators. We were unsuccessful. Once, in our opinion, at least that's what's borne out in the record below, that we were stuck with 1 through 9. And for instance, and this is again supplementing the record in a way, but the sexual assault involving fellatio, potentially we could argue there was no corpus. As to the robbery, we could have argued potentially a nay analysis, that it was an afterthought. But we'd be precluded from those things if 6 through 9 stood, and that's what occurred here. I would just end that I believe a due process violation occurred, that it was fundamentally unfair, and I would submit that due process and fairness should especially be considered, not only in all cases, but this is a capital case, and the stakes are extremely high, and for those reasons, I'd ask that if there's no other questions, that this court reverse.
Are there any questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
This case will stand submitted and will be in recess until the next call of the court.